I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 30th of March. Earlier this month, the American Academy of Pediatrics, which represents 64,000 pediatricians, announced new recommendations to screen for poverty. In a policy statement, the group highlighted the lifelong hardships faced by children who grow up in poverty and called on pediatricians to take action, and we'll hear about the action that is desired this hour of the program. Our guest is Dr. Bernard Dreyer. He is the president of the American Academy of Pediatrics. He's a general and development behavioral pediatrician who spent much of his career serving poor children and families. He's also the former president of the Academic Pediatric Association and founded and chairs the APA Task Force on Childhood Poverty. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Dr. Dreyer during the course of this hour. And to reach the conversation, you can call 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. Dr. Dreyer, thank you very much for being with us. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to be on the show and talk to you about this critical topic.
Yeah, it is a critical one. Let's just start with you. I have read here that you have spent much of your career serving poor children and families. What have you done?
Well, so I'm in New York City, and I'm the among my jobs here is I'm the director of pediatrics at Bellevue Hospital Center. Mm-hmm. I'm professor of pediatrics at NYU as well, but Bellevue is a city hospital, and it serves not primarily, only poor and some low-income families from across the city. And we have for many years been providing special programs to enhance parenting and early childhood development, as well as deal with chronic diseases. And so that has been pretty much my entire career. I've been here since 1976. And I'm here now.
So we
serve also a primarily immigrant population. Mm-hmm. And so we see the problems of poor people, immigrants, homeless family, homelessness, and all the issues that poor families deal with.
Mm-hmm. And the health effects, I'm sure you've seen many of those over the course of your many years, can be quite severe. What are they?
Well, we know that poor children, the much higher rate of infant mortality, also higher rate of low birth weight, which leads to developmental and other health problems after birth, increase in chronic diseases and in severity and frequency of chronic diseases such as asthma and ADHD, increase in obesity, poor nutrition and increased in hunger and inadequate nutrition, leading to poor health. Increased accidents, unintentional accidents, leading to injury and increased death actually among poor children. And all of these are, and of course, those are just the physical health problems.
Right.
There are also the developmental and academic problems that those children face.
Which the report calls toxic stress, right?
Yeah, so one aspect of that is toxic stress. Families, poor families, are stressed out themselves. The parents don't have necessarily the bandwidth when they're trying to try to figure out how to put food on the table or make sure that their heat is not turned off or are working two jobs to make ends meet adequately provide their children with the resources and the environment that they necessarily need to thrive. And so some of that is causes a lot of stress within the family, and the most impacted by that stress is our young children. And we know that that impacts their brain development and their early childhood development and often leads to lifelong emotional, social, and health problems as adults.
The new recommendations encourage pediatricians to screen for poverty-related health risk factors. How does a doctor do that?
Many different ways. So actually, I should back up by saying many of us have been doing this already. We're now sort of asking this to be a universal part of pediatric care because child poverty and low income is so common. One in five children grows up in poverty in the United States, and almost one in two children are living in poverty or near poverty. So, and we know that that near poverty group is really suffering pretty much as the poor kids. So pediatricians are seeing these kids all the time. I mean, almost half of their patients are poor or near poor. This is because children are the poorest segment of our society. Adults are much less poor than children. And seniors who used to be very poor in the 1950s because of expansions in Social Security and Medicare are now the least poor group in our society, which is good. I'm all for seniors not being poor. The question is, why not children as well? So compared to 20% of children being poor, only 10% of seniors are living below the poverty line.
Well, you have to ask the question then, if you have, that's an incredible number, one in two children in poverty or near poverty. That's a huge number of children. So why haven't we done the same for children as we've done for the elderly?
Well, it's a good question. That's one of the questions the Academy is asking. But I think the answer is that we started to do some good things for kids in the 1960s, and then we kind of stopped increasing those programs in the 70s. It isn't, by the way, that we're not doing anything for poor kids. There are a number of programs that really are helping them, lifting them out of poverty and protecting them. In fact, without government programs such as food stamps, tax credits, et cetera, one in three children would be poor rather than one in five. So we are actually doing some good stuff for children, raising a significant number of children out of poverty. We just need to do that in a higher scale and, up the amount that we're focusing on rather than try to cut those programs.
When you're seeing patients, is there a way, because you don't, how do you know if someone is coming from a poor family and doesn't have enough food or hasn't been to the doctor
often? So one of the reasons we're asking pediatricians to screen is that you're not always sure. So, for example, I'll tell you a story that happened to me not long ago in February. I often see families in the clinic with residents because it's a big residency program. And I came in and I was, talking to a family. By the way, these are low-income families, but they always look very together. The kids were always well-dressed. They were very polite. They talked a lot. The family seemed, perfectly happy. I would have not actually predicted that they were having severe problems with getting enough food, for example, not this family. And what we are getting back to the screening, we routinely are screening all the families in our clinics for these so-called social determinants of health. And one of the questions we ask is about food insecurity. Do you ever not have enough money to get enough food on the table, et cetera? And the mother checked off yes to that question. And so we give these in our clinic. This is one method. We give a questionnaire to the parents while they're waiting in the waiting room. They show it to the doctor when they come in the room. In other places, they could show it to the nurse, or it doesn't have to be the doctor. And then if we see the parents check off any of these concerns, such as not enough food, fear of being evicted, fear of not having enough money at the end of the month to make ends meet, not having heat in the house, needing help with child care, et cetera, then in our case, we're a very large program. We have, 65,000 visits a year. So we have a program that we can refer them to somebody in the waiting room to help them get those community resources. So this mother checked off yes to the food insecurity question, and I was actually surprised that was the case. And I started to ask her about it, and she started crying. She broke down crying, and she said her husband no longer has a full-time job, has a part-time job. They've really just not have enough money. They barely can make their rent. And there are a number of nights, especially towards the end of the month, when, you know, there's just not enough money to get enough food to keep her children well fed. And she, you know, broke down. It turns out we could help her. It turns out that she actually didn't think that she qualified for food stamps, but she did, and we could get her connected to getting food stamps, which is a big help. Now, actually, it's no longer food stamps. It's, you know, electronic card, but I use the term food stamps because everybody knows what that means.
Right.
We also could look up and see where there were some food pantries right near where, close to where she lived, so she could go to those food pantries to get some extra food when she needed it. And so we were able to help her with that particular problem. And so this is a good example of you can't always tell by looking. There are other families that look like they really, you know, are very, very poor. This family didn't look like they would not have enough money for food. I wouldn't have routinely just said, you know, do you have enough money for food? But by screening them,
right,
by giving them a questionnaire, I was able to find out that they were having this problem and then help them with it, because we don't just want pediatricians to screen families. That would serve no purpose. We want them to then, if they find a problem, be able to refer them to whatever the community resources are in their community that can help families get help with whatever problem they're having.
So the help component is obviously incredibly important, but it's almost like teachers who have to take on what's going on in families in addition to teaching, and it's a lot on the plate. What do you say, and I'm sure you have some pediatricians who say, my practice is very busy, I don't have the resources, nor do I have the time to then be able to refer everybody.
Yeah, well, a couple of things about that. First of all, actually, most pediatricians know that these families need help and recognize that they are in a position to help them. So we did a survey of pediatricians, and they were all extremely supportive of the Academy moving forward on developing tools for helping them to screen and refer to community resources. What they said to us, however, is we're not quite sure how to do this. So what the Academy is doing is developed resources for easy screening and also templates on how to put together very simple, if that's all you can do, very simple community resources that you can give to the family to seek out themselves. So for a small practice, let's say, who doesn't have many staff, they could just ask one question. Are you having trouble making ends meet at the end of the month? If the answer is yes, then somebody in their practice could find out what is really going on and then refer them to the community resources in their specific community. At a mid-level, they could use a screening tool like we do, which asks 10 questions. The family fills it out. By the way, In our program, it does get reviewed by the doctor, but in many programs, it gets reviewed by a nurse or by actually a medical assistant.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things we stress to pediatricians, and they know this already, is that we're not asking the pediatrician to do this. We're asking the team to do this.
I see.
And in your pediatric practice, it doesn't actually have to be the pediatrician at all. It could be, as I said, the nurse, the medical assistant, a clerk. It could be anybody in your practice who you decide is able to do that. And at a simple level, we're saying if on one side of a page you ask those 10 questions with a little box to check off, on the other side, if you can have somebody find what are one or two resources for each of those problems in your community, and then you can turn that page over and say, here, this is where you can go for help about child care. This is where you can go for help if your utilities are being turned off, et cetera. This is where you can go to help to get, you know, food stamps or to get food pantries. And many pediatricians are already doing this, and we're encouraging everybody to do whatever they can.
It is so hard to be poor in this country, isn't it?
It's getting harder and harder. As you know, one of the things that happened to poor families, and this is not an editorial comment, but it's just the way it is, in the mid-1990s, we got rid of welfare, as we know it, you know, aid to dependent to children in dependent families. So right now, almost no poor people are getting welfare. So you're now supposed to be able to get it for a couple of years while you find a job. But in fact, the vast majority of the welfare money is going elsewhere, and very few poor families are getting that extra cash that they need when they really are out of work.
When you talked about the 1960s and said we were doing something then, what did we abandon?
Well, we did a lot, but we didn't increase it the way we have worked on the elderly. So we Medicaid, big help to children. The one success we've had pretty much in this country for children, by the way, is health insurance. Only 6% of children are uninsured in our country, and about half of those actually could be insured. They just haven't signed up for it. So that means only about 3% of the kids in this country are uninsured, and those are primarily kids who are in immigrant groups in states that are not friendly to immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
So in New York State, we insure all children, for example, and so right now I don't have any poor children that I see that are uninsured. I can get them on either Medicaid or what's called Child Health Insurance Program, CHIP, which is for people just above Medicaid but still in that near-poor category who can't afford insurance. And so in New York State, we will insure all children, whether they're immigrants, whether they're documented immigrants or not. In many states, that's not the case, and those are primarily the kids who are not insured.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, we've done a really good job in this country of insuring children, and that's one of the successes that I think we can all be proud of. What we haven't done is keep up with the costs of families who are poor. So, for example, when the federal poverty level was just invented in the mid-60s, it was assumed that families spent about a third of their budget on food. And so that was true then. That is not true now. Now families spend about a sixth of their budget on food and spend a lot more on housing and on child care. So when we talk about, 20% of kids living below the federal poverty level, that doesn't work anymore because it's 33% of their budget is not on food. Only a sixth of their budget is. So that's why the near poor are still very poor. What we could do now is help them with housing, help them with child care. I think those are two big frontiers. The other thing we can do is bolster up the minimum wage. Most of these families are working. It's not true that most of the poor doesn't work. Most of them are working, often multiple jobs. Although they're at the low end of the totem pole, so they have difficulty getting jobs. So minimum wage is a really big, important help for them. And in our policy, we are encouraging the government to raise the minimum wage, whether that's at the federal level or at state and local level.
Hmm. And the housing issue, I'm sure you're familiar with the book that was written, Evicted,
I read it.
Yeah. It's something that we've overlooked. These people need housing. They're getting their stuff thrown out on the street and going to homeless shelters and paying a huge amount of money for rent.
And so housing is a big issue for not only poor people, but even people above poverty. But certainly the poor are the most easily becoming homeless or living in very substandard housing. And we can do something about that. Cities can do something about that. And we're trying to advocate for housing vouchers can be given in much larger quantity to families who are poor. The housing vouchers that we give so that families can find affordable housing are very limited in number, and they don't anywhere near approach the number of people who need some help with housing. So that's by the way, one of the big areas that's changed. In the 1960s, housing was much cheaper, and there were many more units that were available to poorer families to live in. Due to gentrification of much of our cities and the increased cost for housing, most poor people can't afford housing unless it's subsidized. Subsidizing housing is critical. And kids,
right.
I'll just tell you a story. When I started getting involved as an advocate, at the city level here in New York City, I got involved in the mid-'80s because there was an epidemic of family homelessness. We didn't really have that many homeless families before then. But due to gentrification of large parts of the city, due to poor housing policy where we started cutting those vouchers and the support for poor families to get housing, and due to, at that point, crack cocaine epidemic as well, we suddenly were flooded with many, many families that didn't have a place to go. And we, at that point, I was shocked that there were about 5,000 families and about 11,000 children who were living in shelters.
Mm.
And I'm embarrassed to say that today in New York City, there are 11,000 families and 22,000 children living in shelters.
Our guest this hour is Dr. Bernard Dreyer. He is president of the American Academy of Pediatrics. He is also a professor of pediatrics at NYU and director of pediatrics at Bellevue Hospital. We're talking about a report that was released early in March, new recommendations to the 64,000 pediatricians who are members of the AAP, and it looks at poverty and child health. They have recommendations for pediatricians and having them become not only advocates, but to try and figure out if people have enough food to eat, if they're having problems with housing, because the results of being very poor as a child, the health results can be really severe: diabetes, asthma, lower immunization rates, higher chance of dying in infancy, toxic stress, the list goes on, and it can really have lifetime consequences. So what is it that pediatricians can do? And I guess a larger question, too, when you're looking at, I mean, that number is unbelievable. 1 in 2 children in this country living in poverty or near poverty. It's not true of the elderly among us. We decided to do something about that and nearly eliminated poverty in the elderly. Why don't we do the same for children? That's the question of the hour. Why don't we do the same for children? Here's our phone number. Please join us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for our guest this hour, 800-486-8655. Dr. Bernard Dreyer is our guest, and we start our calls with Pat in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Pat.
Hi, thank you for the program. I wanted to mention that I recently saw a documentary on public TV, and I had seen it before this, maybe like in the last month. The title was called Poor Kids, and I don't remember who produced it or who wrote that, but when I saw it, it was so touching, and I was thinking that every politician and every person in the country should see that. It should be required viewing for especially people who control money. It followed at least 2 families, and it brought you right into their lives. And honestly, after seeing that, there are images that I will never, ever get out of my mind or my heart. Just extremely powerful, showing just how poverty affects these families. It was heart-wrenching, and every one of us needs to see that over and over again.
Dr. Dreyer.
Thank you so much for that comment. I think you're bringing up an important point that for many people, the poor are bizarrely invisible because our society is segregated by income,
mm-hmm.
so that many people don't see that side of the world, even though almost 1 in 2 children are living in poverty or near poverty. One of the reasons I think that pediatricians have decided to speak up about this is that we do see these families. They're almost half of our patients are living in poverty or near poverty. So we see the families. These are loving, good families. The image of the poor as somehow causing their own problems. There are people who have problems, but mostly they're loving families that want to do the right thing for their kids and just are in a situation where they're hardly, you know, able to put food on the table. And so it's hard for them to worry about whether they, you know, read to their kids or teach them numbers and letters when they're worried about, is there enough heat? Is there enough food? Am I going to be living here or on the street tomorrow?
Thank you, Pat, very much. I would imagine that film is available somehow in this highly tech world, right? Poor families. And maybe it'll be shown again and should be. Lynn on Facebook writes, my principal came into my classroom and made me hand over breakfast snacks that I kept on hand for children who had not eaten. I was told that feeding them was not my job and that I was only enabling them. In Wisconsin, we've made it so hard for people to use SNAP to provide public transportation or even to provide grocery stores in poor areas.
So, again, wonderful points. I do want to point out something about the school school meals program, because this is reflected. The AAP is really advocating for real improvements in school meals. School meals often make up at least half the calories that poor kids have every day. Without those meals, they would not have an adequate diet. So they are critical for kids. And school meal money comes from the feds. It is somewhat supported by the states, but that's where you have to advocate in your states to really make sure that schools not only provide lunches but provide breakfasts. There are also community rules. If at least 40% of the kids in your school qualify for school meals, that school or that school district can ask for community designation, so they don't have to. They can give school meals to all their kids if at least 40% of them are poor. So there are lots of important aspects of school meals to get the right nutrition to kids. Now, why that specific principal didn't want that teacher to give snacks, I don't know. I know many teachers have snacks and lots of other things for the kids in their classrooms.
Mm-hmm. Mary in Eau Claire, hi.
Hello?
Yes, Mary, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Love your show, and I love this topic. And I really appreciate all that he's doing in order to make and bridge that gap. One of my questions was if you have any statistics on the growing number of middle-class families that are working multiple jobs just to provide, to make ends meet, to take care of their families. But unfortunately, they don't qualify for the assistance to help them get through. And I myself personally see a growing trend in that where families are working multiple jobs in order to provide, but yet they don't qualify. Do you have any statistics on regards to families trying to struggle in that manner?
Well, I can tell you a couple of things. Some of those families are actually living in at least near poverty. And if they are living in near poverty, they do qualify for some of those benefits. So, for example, there's something called the Earned Income Tax Credit and the Child Tax Credit, which are refunded to families. And those are big helps to families' budgets. And many people that you see as your neighbors who you think are not getting those refunds, if they're not, they often qualify for it. So that's one way that the government does help not just the poor but the people sort of above the poverty line. You're also bringing up another important statistic, which is that the fastest growing group of poor kids are in suburbia, especially since the housing crisis. So many families who were middle class are now barely at the edge of it or have dropped into poverty. Poverty and near poverty is everywhere. It's not just in the rural areas. It's not just in the inner city. In fact, there are many, many struggling families in suburbia. The problems that those families have are compounded by the fact that suburbia, the suburbs don't usually have access to those agencies and social programs that really focus on the poor as much as people living in the city.
With this, Dr. Dreyer, being as large a problem as it is and ignored for so many decades as it is, why is it that, and what does it take? We're in the midst of an endless presidential campaign here with very few people talking. They're talking about the middle class for the most part, right, and not about people who are poor in this country.
Yes.
It just hasn't been a part of the national conversation, and I wonder why and what would make it so.
Well, so the AAP is nonpartisan and bipartisan, so I'm constrained to talk about, you know, people's policies. But I think in general, it's been viewed as not a subject you can talk about if you want to get votes.
Mm.
And I think, you know, elections are all about getting votes. I'm disappointed that it's not a part of a greater conversation. And by the way, we are prepared, once there are two candidates, we have a whole agenda on childhood poverty that we're going to be presenting to the candidates to say, so what are you going to do about these problems? So try to get this into the conversation. I think you're making a great point. Why aren't we talking more about this?
Thanks, Mary, for your call. Ashley in Coloma. Hi, Ashley.
Hi. I wanted to bring up something. I believe it was World War II, where there was a very high promotion of Victory Garden. And I believe what I read about it said that that provided close to 40% of the nation's produce intake. And I've always thought with today's growing technologies of aquaponics or hydroponics, you don't even need a yard anymore, that if that was put into some of these SNAP programs, that would be another way to help these families have a healthy diet and free up a little extra cash for other things that they have to pay for. So
I think many families in suburban or rural areas do have gardens that supplement their food. It's hard in an inner city. Hydroponics just goes so far. You really need a garden. And there's just, I mean, since housing is such a big problem for the poor and the near poor, you know, creating a system which is sounds wonderful but is based on having some land which you can work on doesn't work for most of these families. There are families, I know that, I know families who are living in the outer boroughs of New York where they have a little patch of land and are definitely growing their own vegetables. But, you know, growing vegetables is not cheap, and so you need money for seeds, for tilling the ground. If you're working two jobs, it's hard to come home and till your little victory garden. In World War II, most women were staying at home taking care of families and not working after, you know, during the war, and they were, you know, that so that became something they could work on. It's now most of poor families, the mother is working, as well as the father.
Thank you, Ashley, very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're talking about this very interesting list of recommendations from the American Academy of Pediatrics calling childhood poverty one of the most widespread and persistent health risks facing children. They're now recommending that there be screening of families during perhaps well-child checkups or at other times to find out if families are having trouble making ends meet and then referring families to resources that may be beneficial. And that's what we're talking about with Dr. Bernard Dreyer this hour of the show. He's president of the American Academy of Pediatrics. He has spent since 1976, when he started working in this area, working with poor children and families. And he's a professor of pediatrics at NYU and director of pediatrics at Bellevue Hospital in New York. Our phone number, we'll take more phone calls momentarily, is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, back to phone calls for Dr. Dreyer. Mark in Richland Center. Hi, Mark.
Hey, thank you for the program. The state of North Dakota has this unique situation where they are looking at a bill that would put money in the bank for every child born in the state. It seems like it's not really connected to to pediatrics, but it is because the monetary system they have in the State Bank of North Dakota is that all of the people own the bank. And so the state of North Dakota has a surplus in their state budget, and what to do with the state surplus, they're considering, well, why don't we put money aside for every child born in the state? Now, if they're going to leave it in the bank for the kids to accumulate over 20 years, they would all have a college fund. But the question is, with regard to health and well-being of the population in North Dakota at least owns a bank. No yeah. other state does, though there are lots, including the state of New York. Lots of other states are considering the ownership of a state bank because that state hasn't had anything but a budget surplus, even through the downturn of this economic time. So the question really is, with regard to pediatrics and with regard to college education and with regard to all the other things that the people want to do, if the people do not own the money itself, the money system, the bank, somebody else does that is in this place called far, far away, then the money just goes far away and it doesn't stay here with us.
Dr. Dry.
So that's a wonderful commentary. I think one of the issues we're dealing with in this country now, and which it sounds like at least in North Dakota there's attention to, is the huge increase in income inequality. So, for example, the latest upturn in our economy has helped primarily or only people sort of at the top of the economy. Most people in the middle class have seen stagnant wages and stagnant economic status, and poor people have, to some degree, gotten even poorer. So even though we've had an economic recovery, it has not reached the majority of the people who need it the most. So I think it's an intriguing idea to think about what you could do with a state-owned bank. I have to say, in North Dakota, probably has one of the lowest child. I can't find it in my mind at the moment, but it's one of the lowest child poverty rates in the country.
Oh, that's interesting. We should do a show on that, Mark. If you have more information, it'd be a good show. Dean in Green Bay is next. Hi, Dean.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is a great opportunity for me. I worked in the field for 30 years, mental health. I'm a licensed therapist in Wisconsin, and I worked for the last 16 years with children in poverty, and there's two things that have concerned me that I came up with as to why the system struggles. One is when you talk to people, I feel like when you work in the field, it's like you want to be this person that runs around and tells people how bad it is so people can get together and fix it. And what you get a lot from people are anecdotes about parents who don't take care of their children. And, you know, it's like, well, yeah, okay, but the children still need help. And maybe we need to help the parents and the children and not blame the parents, and that gives us an excuse not to help the children. I really see that a lot. And it was very discouraging. It has been. And then another thing that I'm sure is kind of controversial, but I think that, and obviously you have to protect the identity and the confidentiality of people, but I think the flip side of that is people don't know how bad it is.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Dry.
Yeah, so getting to your first point, a very important point. I've often spoken to groups about child poverty, and there's a lot of blaming the parents for it. I've even had somebody say to me the following: I'd love to help poor children, but I don't want to help their parents who could be doing better. Mm-hmm. So I think that is a barrier. Now, there are two answers to that. Number one, the majority of poor children are living in families with a mother and a father. Usually one or both are working. So the image of the single parent, you know, who's on drugs, which is, I think, sort of a classic image, is true, but it is a minority of the people who are poor. And even those adults who are now single parents and perhaps involved in drugs, they were poor kids themselves, and we have produced them this way, and their kids will grow up in the same intergenerational poverty system unless we do something about it.
Hmm.
It's estimated that child poverty costs this country $500 billion a year.
Goodness.
The problem with our not doing anything about it is that those costs are mostly when those kids grow up to be adults. But, yeah, our Congress gets elected every 2 years. They're not interested in something that's going to make a difference in 15 or 20 years from now.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for your call, Dean. Judith sends an interesting email from Fitchburg. As a registered dietitian, I'm interested to know if the data that you've collected, doctor, from the 10-question food access survey goes into an online database. Do you and other pediatricians capture the information for your entire practice group, city, county, state? It seems like systematically collecting and sharing the data would help your local public health agencies and WIC programs partner with pediatricians and keeping families from falling through the cracks.
Yeah, great, great comments. So, yes, it actually is occurring at a national level. We have very good data at the national and state level as to how many kids are hungry or are food insecure. This is well known in community, not even at the practice level, at the city or at the state, certainly at the federal level. So we know the data, and the policymakers know the data, and that's why there is some support for programs like SNAP, which is food stamps, or school meals, or WIC. Number two, I think pediatricians and WIC programs have collaborated for many, many years. So that's the WIC program is for pregnant women and young children.
Mm-hmm.
And so there we have been sort of connected at the hip. Pretty much all pediatricians know where the WIC program is in their community, refer to the WIC program if the parents are not already enrolled in the newborn nursery. And so there's a lot of collaboration there. There's less collaboration with food pantries and with making sure parents are enrolled in SNAP or food stamps. And that's one of the things we're trying to focus on now.
Julie in Madison. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
Hi.
I think this is really timely because not too long ago, the Pew Charitable Trust, I think, released a study that showed that there are more people in Wisconsin who are falling out of the middle class than in any other of the states. And there's also a UW-Madison report that shows that there has been an increase in children living in poverty in Wisconsin. And I was wondering if the doctor could talk about the long-term effects on children and their success in terms of their ability to grow up and live up to their potential. Because I know there can be serious health consequences, both through toxic stress and other challenges with children living in poverty. And this is really important for, I think, all people, whether you know someone who's living in poverty or not, because the cost to society and all of us are significant, not only to just that child or family who's
mm-hmm.
growing up
Absolutely,
who are
yeah.
living in poverty.
Yes. Yes, we focused on some specific health problems earlier in the show, but I would like to focus now on early childhood, early brain development, school readiness, academic programs, and then what happens to kids when they're poor and teenagers. So we know, I talk about kids, I often show a picture of a newborn brain and a brain of a two-year-old. And the brain of a two-year-old is about three times the size and Ooh. Weight of a newborn. So think about what is going on in that child's brain in those 2 years. You can't make up for that very easily. You really can't. And so, by the way, the two-year-old brain is not much smaller than an adult brain, which is, I usually joke, that's why there are a lot of adults acting like two-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
But, that is just such an amazing opportunity for us to change a child's life forever or a lost opportunity. So one of our recommendations in the poverty policy to the policymakers is focus on early childhood. It's hard to make up for a lost early childhood, and that means parenting programs to help parents do what they really need to do but may not be able to do. Home visiting programs, interventions in primary care like Reach Out and Read and other interventions that help parents learn how to be better parents. You know, universal preschool, high-quality universal preschool and high-quality childcare, so that children are really being nurtured all through early childhood. And, you know, we know that those programs make a big difference in whether children come to school ready to learn or not. And if they're not nurtured in early childhood, they enter school and they hit a brick wall because their language is not there. Their ability to sit still or pay attention or socialize appropriately is not there. And they become failures very quickly. Poor children, we know that by school entry, there's a huge grade gap between the abilities of poor children and middle-class children at the start of school, and mostly it's very hard to make that up. So, and when they end up being older, there's a much higher high school dropout rate, much higher, getting into trouble with drugs or crime as teenagers, leading to really a lifetime of a lack of promise and intergenerational poverty. Mm.
Julie, thanks for your call. We'll try and take two more calls if we can. Let's go to Nick in Beloit. Hi, Nick.
Hi. Obviously, a very complicated situation that's not going to be covered with one fix or anything else, but it also isn't going to be fixed with Band-Aid approaches. It's got to be fixed at the source. I just pretty much got done raising three kids, and I can tell you how hard it is and how expensive it is. And I think you're going to have a lot more success with one or two kids than three, four, or five. There's got to be family planning. There's got to be incentives for people to choose that route. But they also have to get the information. It needs to come from the pediatrician. It needs to come from the church. The church can't simply say, multiply, be fruitful. That doesn't work anymore.
All right, Dr. Dreyer.
Yes, absolutely. That you're making an extremely important point. We have, by the way, made some significant headways in teenage pregnancy. It's really dropped.
Yes, remarkable.
But we have a long ways to go. And I think making family planning services available to teenagers and adults is a critical part of an anti-poverty program. We support all efforts to improve access, to make sure that teenagers are given access to LARC, long-acting, reversible contraception, which we know is much more effective. Given the opportunity to use birth control, poor families will choose to have fewer children.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Nick. We have a minute left. One more question. Sarah in Friendship. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering if the doctor, Dr. Dreyer, could respond to any efforts the AAP is doing to work with other provider networks and other perhaps nurse practitioners or other family practice associations, because of the fact that most of our families in rural communities have no access or very limited access to a pediatrician.
Okay.
Absolutely. I know I have like 30 seconds. We're reaching out to nurse practitioners, to family practitioners, to PAs, to physician assistants. Right now, nurse practitioners and family and physician assistants can be associate members of the AAP, and we often work with the family practitioners on many of these issues, and absolutely are reaching out to them to try to get one voice to talk about these things and to do something about it.
Thank you, Sarah. Dr. Dreyer, thank you so much for all the information, as it is, but also for being somebody who's been making a difference for so many years. That's good. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Our pleasure. Dr. Bernard Dreyer, he is the president of the American Academy of Pediatrics. They came out with a report. I think we have this on our Facebook page, the Kathleen Dunn Show, if you want to read more about this. Early in March, they represent 64,000 pediatricians, and they are asking for new recommendations to screen for poverty. Poverty, a huge issue among children in this country. Not many people paying attention. He's also director of pediatrics at Bellevue Hospital and a professor at NYU. We thank him for being with us. Thanks to Chris Molina for producing this hour. Thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. And for all of your calls and concern, thanks, everybody. News is coming up. Milwaukee in World War II, Hour 2.